Welcome back to another edition of the Fried Egg Podcast. Today's episode is brought to you by our friends over at Be Dratty. It is fall. I am going to be on the ground at the Ryder Cup next week, and I see some cooler temperatures in the forecast. So one new item that I just got, we gave them out at our most recent event at White Bear Yacht Club, the Regatta. And we have a new item that's going in the pro shop with a logo on it, is the Dratty Sport Blair Half Zip. I believe it's named after Zach Blair. I'm not positive. It could be another Blair. It could be a first name Blair. I'm not sure. But anyways, this is a new half zip that is in the line for Be Dratty this fall. It is awesome. It's that sport material that everybody knows, but it's done dratty way, it's got a unique feel that differentiates it from a lot of the sport materials that you feel like you're putting like a bag over yourself. This material, it's really soft, breathable, but it's warm, and it's a great fit. I'd say it's a little bit snugger than most dratties. So if you're kind of in between sizes, size up. But it is a great piece, and I can't wait to have some of them in the shop. Of course, you can buy this on BeDratty.com today. You can use the code TFE25 for 25% off, and get ready for fall ball in most of the north part of the states. So check out that Dratty Sport Blair Half Zip, and thank you to BeDratty for all the support this year. Today's episode is with the CEO of the USGA, the new CEO of the USGA, Mike Wan. We have talked to Mike in the past when he was the commissioner of the LPGA. We interviewed Mike this week at Chicago Golf Club, one of the five founding clubs of the USGA, and had a chat that centered around championship venues, municipal golf, and, of course, distance. So, without further ado, here is the new CEO of the USGA, Mike Wan.
I miss a green, for example. I'm already upset. When I find my ball in the bunker, I'm really upset. And when I find my ball in a
fried egg.
Fried egg.
The dreaded fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg lie, I'm about ready to run off the golf course.
Mike, we're here at Chicago Golf, one of the founding five clubs of the USGA. I'm curious. I know you've been digging into the history of the USGA, and these clubs were fundamental in getting the USGA started. What do you think their role is now in American golf?
You know, first, let me take the first part of your question. So when I got to the USGA, I went over to the museum, I think on my second day, and I asked for a little tour of, you know, through the history. And in the museum hangs the first page of the original Constitution, written by the five clubs. And I got to tell you, as a Chicagoan, as a Naperville guy, to see Chicago Golf Club, it hit me. And when I got to the club in their lobby, their historian said to me, "This is the only place this is on display." And it's the same thing. It's the first page. And I'm like, "It's not the only place it's on display." And what I did from the museum is I asked the museum to take a picture of that page. I had it blown up and framed, and now it hangs in my office. Because I want everybody who walks into my office to return to how the USGA was originally formed in 1894. You know, I started a tournament at the LPGA called the Founders because I wanted our members, my staff, my board, young girls to remember like where the roots of the LPGA are. And this place where we're sitting in Chicago, this is the roots of the USGA. So I think these clubs understood their responsibility for the future of this game before we did. And so I said to them, I feel a responsibility back to them, and I hope they still feel it to us, that this was formed to create national championships. It was formed to create common governance and rules, and it was formed to make sure golf was better 30 years from the time they signed the document. Now it's 130 years, but I think we all still have the same responsibility, you know, to create championships where the best can play and showcase, to create governance whereby we can all play under the same set of rules, and most importantly, to make sure that our kids' kids have a better game than we do. And I don't think anything's changed since 1894.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, the founder here, C.B. McDonald, was a big part of the founding of the USGA because, you know, his many rules controversies were what was spurned. We need to have an ideal set of rules. You know, it might have been a sore loser, but more so, he needed the rules. So
same thing might be true for the U.S. Amateur. I think a few people were calling it their National Amateur Championship, and he didn't win those first two, so he decided those two weren't official.
Yeah.
So let's make sure we create one official. And of course, I think in the third amateur played, he won, so that one was now official.
Mm-hmm. So with these clubs, obviously they. You know, they founded it. We're going to see the Country Club next year as a, you know, hosting a national championship. You got Shinnecock National Championship. You know, Newport's had national championships. Is that kind of, you know, obviously the historical aspect a big part of them becoming more championship courses, or do they have a fundamental role other than just those are the clubs that started the USGA?
Yeah, I wouldn't say that, you know, we sit around the USGA and talk about the five courses and what things are we going to do with the five courses, but we're like anybody else. I mean, we're like any other business. You respect the, like when the NHL talks about the founding clubs and Chicago, you know, gets the respect there too. It's, it matters your roots. It matters where you started. And the fact that we can have championships at these facilities, is cool. It's not mandatory. I don't think that has to take place, but I think there's only a few clubs that can take the pride, the fact that they envisioned the USGA before the USGA did. And I think as a result, there's always going to be something special between us and them. I mean, and when I walked onto this property, I felt the history, not just of this property, but I felt the history of the foresight, you know, right, wrong, or indifferent, the foresight to create a governing body. And I feel the responsibility to make sure that, you know, in the next at least 10 years, that I help push that, you know, pass that baton farther and push the, you know, the definition of what we should be doing for the game to a new level.
Mm-hmm. With a, you know, kind of pushing it in a direction, obviously, there's a lot of things. Golf's in a boom right now. It's more popular than ever. So what are the big issues that, obviously, you're just getting your feet wet? You're first year on the job, and you know, what are the big, you know, kind of issues that are coming across your desk as of now? Like, what are the kind of the things that you've focused on in your first few months?
Yeah, I mean, I'd love to. I mean, that's an answer that could take a while, but I think I could probably build it under a few key categories. It's what I'm asking all of us to do at the USGA is to assess our championships and make sure they're at least as strong as they were 20 years ago, and show me a plan to make sure that we believe they'll be even stronger 20 years from now. I don't think we want to take our national championships as a given. I think we want to continue to push ourselves and make sure we're pushing that, whether that's where we play, purses, television coverage, fan experience. I think we've got to keep asking ourselves, you know, wherever we thought we were in 1985 or 2005, are we going to be there in 2035? So we spent a lot of time on championships. I think we spent a lot of time on the topics of uniting the game, whether that's course ratings, world handicapping system, gins, all things we can do to make sure that players around the world can really get connected to this game. The other thing that I've spent more time on than I really thought I would spend time on is how are we being an efficient and effective partner in the game and for these courses. You know, we have an incredible agronomy program, an incredibly green section. Are we making that accessible to everybody? How can we take that to the next level? How can we make sure we're providing help? At some courses, maybe Chicago Golf Club doesn't need our help, but maybe Springbrook does. And are we available to that? I only use Springbrook because it's my hometown growing up course. But you know, is the USGA being the kind of partner it needs to be across the board? And so I'm new, of course, and I'm just kind of looking at those things saying, I want to make sure that, I always say that the USGA is like the role player on a basketball team. I don't care if tonight you need me to set picks, guard their best score, or be the best scorer. Let's agree that we'll be whatever it takes and whatever topic. So I think a lot of times big corporations like the USGA think they always have to be at the front of the parade. They have to be leading the initiative. I don't feel that at all. I feel like if Jay's going to lead drive, chip, and putt, how can we help? If Augusta's going to lead or lead drive, chip, and putt, how can we help? If Jay's going to lead first tee, how can we help? If Seth is onto something at the PGA with regards to junior league, how do we get involved and help push that? We don't always have to be at the front of the parade. Sometimes we just have to be supporting the parade. And I think there's so many good ideas in the game that we don't, I feel like sometime at the USGA, we almost are ashamed that all we did is wrote a check to somebody. Well, sometimes that's all that somebody needed was a check. Sometimes they need us to actually take a much bigger role. And I don't want to be the kind of role, I want to be the kind of role player that said whatever golf needed, the USGA was a trusted partner that could be there for them. And sometimes that means we're going to have to be in the front and at the microphone talking about what's next. And sometimes we'll be just one in the crowd helping them get there. But I think the game needs to count on us to be a partner where we're needed.
It sounds almost like parenting.
Maybe. Although parenting, sometimes I feel like we have to do more of the scolding. And I think in this case, we have to do more of the supporting. You know, it's maybe parenting once your kids get to college.
Yeah. Your answer brought up a topic that I was interested in talking about a little bit. It was what's the USGA's role kind of in supporting municipal golf? Obviously, we've seen varying levels of support from the USGA over the years. From, you know, you look at the Bethpage Black situation where that was, you know, fully involved, getting one of the great municipal facilities that in the United States restored, and, you know, bringing a championship there. And obviously with Torrey Pines this year, that was the last, championship golf event on, you know, big time championship golf scheduled for municipal golf. And I think that's obviously the most obvious and visible USGA municipal golf role, kind of collaboration. But I'm interested in, how do you view the USGA and supporting municipal golf, which is so much, so fundamental in where people get the start in the game?
Yeah, I mean, I'm gonna say something here that I don't normally say, and you'll get a kick out of this, but I don't normally say, if at all. I've got a lot to learn in that area, because usually I think I've, of course, got all the answers, but I do have a lot to learn in that area. What I would tell you is I think we spend too much time talking about championships when we talk about different venues, and not enough time talking about what do they need, period, because the championship is one golf course and it's one moment. But, you know, we've got thousands of golf courses that we need to figure out how to become a better partner to. And what I've learned, if nothing else, in 60 days is there's not a one size fits all when it comes to venue support, when it comes to really being a partner to golf courses. Some of them need agronomy help. Some of them want to really talk to the green section. Some of them need guidance on how to run their own championships. Some of us need membership growth or gin support, or how can we do a better rating? So what I think we've got to figure out a way to do is how do we become a better consultant to the golf courses that want it and need it. And some don't need us at all. And I think we got to get over ourselves that if some don't need us at all, that's just fine. We don't have to be everybody's answer. So I really don't know yet. I was just talking to somebody before you walked in, and I said, I can promise you in 6 or 7 months, you're going to hear about Mike Wan's big, bold leadership initiatives. I don't know what they're going to be yet, but there's going to be 4 or 5 things that I'm going to lay on the table and say, in the next 5 to 10 years, we're going to get there. I'm not exactly sure what those initiatives are, but that's kind of what I've always done. I mean, when I got to the LPGA, I think 1 year in, I said, we're going to get the future golf to 50-50 men and women. At the time, I think it was, I don't know, 20% of junior golf was women. It's, you know, close to, it's almost 40% now. So I didn't get there, but I'm not ashamed of the fact that I threw it on the table, made us challenge ourselves. I want to have some big, bold initiatives of what we're going to do as the USGA. What are we going to sign up for? And over the next 15 to 30 years, not willing to back down on. And I've got my head around 3 or 4 of them. I'm just not ready to go public yet. But when we get there, there's got to be a few things. As a leader in the sport, we've got to be the one who wakes up every day and says, 30 years from now, we're going to get here. Because I don't think everybody else can spend time thinking about 30 years from now. They got members to serve and things to generate this quarter or this month or this year. But I want to be the one that says, in 30 years, here's where we're going to help golf get to, and then not be willing to back down over the next 30. And getting those right and getting my members, my volunteers, and my board to get behind those, I think is really my job.
It's got to be an interesting transition. Obviously, you were wildly successful with your leadership at the LPGA. I think, you know, where LPGA is today, obviously, it helped, you know, television, more television exposure and highlighting the great players on the LPGA tour has brought new popularity to the sport. You know, having that being probably was a little bit easier of a problem, in the sense of it's the LPGA and we're going to focus on our core product. With the USGA, you've got so many different areas of the game of golf. It encompasses all of golf, and then also a lot more people that, you know, you collaborate with within it beyond, you know, just whether it be sponsors, tournament organizers, and, you know, venues and players. You have, you know, every, you have all of those as well as many other people that you work with. How is the, you know, kind of determining those key fundamental priorities? Is it been a little bit more difficult than, say, the LPGA, or is it, you know, how do you go about that process?
Yeah, they are different, but I would tell you that one thing is completely true. You'll never show me a really successful business or brand that was pretty good on a bunch of stuff. They're great on a few things, and to be great at a few things, you have to say no at a bunch of other stuff. And I think that'll be a challenge for me in this job. I mean, I think sometimes the USGA wants to be able to say, yes, we did, no matter what the question was. Yes, we did a little bit there, and we did a little bit there. We wrote a check to them. We helped them on such and such. And I'd rather say no, we didn't a few times to be really great at a few things. And I think that's, you know, that's feasible. The good news for me is there's so many people in the golf industry, so many organizations and leaders that have taken a big, active, and successful role in parts of the business that I don't need to go solve. I don't need to, you know, try to get my face on that poster. That's working out all by itself. So I think the big challenge with the USGA, and this is what I was talking about before, is I'm going to figure out the five or six things that we will not fail at. And unfortunately, when you hear those five or six things, you'll probably go, yeah, that sounds right. And then you'll want to naturally go, but what about, and you'll rattle off six or seven more. Just know if they weren't in those five or six, I'm probably not going to spend a lot of time, at least my personal time, on those other things. If we're going to succeed, we're going to be great at five or six things, and we're not going to be willing to fail at those five or six things. And yeah, that means we're probably not going to be, we're not going to be involved in a bunch of others. I think golf needs that. It's what's achievable. And that formula is almost identical to what we did at the LPGA.
That makes sense. It's like the maniacal focus more so, you know, it's so easy to get scatterbrained and chase a bunch of different things. And when you do a bunch of things, it's like the restaurant with 200 things on the menu. It's like, what's
if you want to be great at 20 things, go be great at four, and then be great at four more, and then be great at four more. Don't try to be great at 20 in the beginning. So I think at the USGA, we've got to decide what are the four or five or six things we're going to hang on the board. We are not going to back down from. And as we start knocking those off, fine, hang another couple things on the board, but don't start with 20.
So obviously, in terms of championship, we just talked about how we talk too much about championships, but you know,
here we go.
We're going to talk about championships.
Okay, got it.
You guys, big announcement a couple of weeks ago with the anchor sites of Marion and Oakmont, partnership with Pennsylvania. What do the, you know, anchor sites provide you guys? And I feel like everybody wants to call it a ROTA, but you know, you guys have very much shied away from the ROTA term that RNA uses. How is it different than a ROTA?
Well, first off, you know, we're not talking about going somewhere forever. And we're also not talking about it like a standard series of years. What I would say is what people have misread in the anchor site piece is in these cases, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, we've been able to say to both sites and states, if we bring it, can we get behind it? In other words, what happens almost every time is you finish a championship with somebody and they'd say, you know what would have been nice here? If we could have put villas down the left side of this thing, or it would have been great if we would have had plumbing back at the barn because we could have turned the barn into a... Everybody knows after they run a championship, the thing they wish they could have done. But you can't go do that without kind of guaranteed knowledge of revenue in the future. So when we can sit across the table and talk to a Pinehurst or talk to an Oakmont or a Marion or Saucon Valley and say, you know, if you know we're coming, you know, numerous times in the next 20 years, what can we go do together? What can we build to make sure these championships are better? Because usually you can't go build. Even if you're Oakmont and you don't know the USGA is coming back, you can have some grand plan. But how do you go out and really invest in that if you don't think there's revenue to come behind that investment? So I really feel like what's the benefit of these anchor sites isn't that to know we're playing there in 7 years or we're playing an amateur there in 14 years. It's knowing what these sites and these cities and states can do and investing in these places, knowing that they're going to bring this level of excitement, beds and heads, fans, television revenue. It allows them to invest in a property. And when they invest in a property, we can create a better championship for our players, a better championship for our TV partners. And most importantly, we can create a better championship for our fans. So the guarantee of us coming creates investment in the properties and in the states that we wouldn't get otherwise. We could just say in you know, we came here and we may come back again later, but this is going to, you're going to see real investments in these properties that came out of the knowledge of knowing that we were coming back.
In a way, you know, when you were describing that, it made me think of Augusta National and what they're able to do with the Masters and ANWA, and because they know it's coming back every single year. So they're able to make investments, improve. They can look at something and say, hey, this didn't work. The spectator flow didn't work here. And all of a sudden it's fixed next year. Their merchandise tents are, you know, seamless places because they know every year and year out. And what you're doing is, you know, as opposed to it being just an unfamiliar house that you're hosting a party in, you're going back to those houses regularly in a way.
Yeah. I would tell you this, that the majority of the U.S. Open, U.S. Women's Open, U.S. amateur sites will not be tied to an anchor site, but we will have a small minority that are. And because of that, your point is exactly right. These championships will look at a championship and say, how do we invest in the next one? Because we know there is a next one. And whether you're talking about North Carolina and the investment we're making together in our test facility and consumer facility, and therefore the champions, or whether you're talking about Oakmont and Marion, where we can make investments to make the, you know, make the actual championship better. I think you'll hear about another anchor site or two in the years to come, but you won't hear about five or six more.
So, you know, you opening that door, and as a Midwesterner, I think everybody in the Midwest looks around and sees East Coast, and you can't sell me that Pittsburgh's Midwest. As somebody from Chicago, that's just, I've never ever thought that, you know, even though some people contend that it is. You see West Coast anchor sites. In the PGA move to May is really limited major championship golf in the Midwest. So can we potentially expect to see some sort of Midwest anchor site?
Anchor site, I don't know. Championships, yes. I mean, I fully intend that we'll see championships come through Chicago and the Midwest. I mean, I would consider Pittsburgh, but I get it. I would come through the Midwest. But anchor sites are bigger entities. It's more than just a club. It's a club. It's a county. It's a city. It's a state. I don't know if there's appetite for that. Maybe. But like I said, we're not in a hurry to roll out more anchor sites. We're, you know, at the end of the day, these anchor sites will be few and far between, but they will create some continuity and some investment that'll be great. But I don't want to wake up in 3 years to your roto comment and go, well, I know what 30 through 43 is, and there's no room in there for us to introduce other sites, important sites, one-offs. I mean, there's a lot of great clubs that would like to do this once or maybe twice, but they don't want to do it every 10 years. They don't want to do it every 8 years. And I don't want to cross them off because they weren't part of some anchor agreement.
Yeah, it's an interesting strategy because obviously when you have them planned out, it creates leverage and scarcity, but you also never know what's going to happen, say 1 year, or somebody might decide they want something. So you want to have some availability. You kind of almost want to have a table or two available in case a celebrity comes in your restaurant, right?
Yeah, and I would tell you, I'm without any hesitation, and I'm not BSing you, there is no anchor sites were not designed to create scarcity and therefore higher demand. If it works out that way, I mean, I'm saying that we didn't sit down and go, you know what we could do? If we could just lock up a couple of dates every decade, that would just mean two less slots for everybody else. Anchor sites came out of the fact that if we could really get long-term thinking, long-term investment, in some of the markets that we know we'd come back to anyway, it would be great if we could. And then it led to, look what it turned into. But it wasn't designed to have, you know, fewer opportunities. And like I said, we'll be fully committed to making sure that there are one-offs and there are regular stops that are or aren't tied to anchor sites. We're never going to find ourselves waking up going, geez, we'd love to really do a championship there, but anchor sites have 9 of 10 years locked up. That won't be part of our future.
With all the championships, there, I mean, there's so many to choose from. I'm just curious, is there one that you have highlighted in your head as this is the championship I'm most looking forward to in the next couple of years?
No, there isn't. I mean, I'll be honest with you. There's one or two that aren't on the docket that I'd be most looking forward to getting over the hump. But you know, the cool thing to me is, I mean, I've been floored with, you know, when you, this summer I've been going to all the different championships, and yeah, you know, the Country Club in Boston is going to be unbelievable. I haven't been there in, you know, 30 years. And I can't wait to, you know, I'm going to start lying down the list. I mean, am I excited about LACC? I am. You know, I've played LACC a few times. I lived out in California for a while. And I know that it won't just be a great championship for the athletes and for the sponsors that'll be there. But there'll be people in LA that probably never even seen inside that gates that'll walk in as fans and see a great piece of property. So I'm excited about that. But the best part about this whole USGA experience that I've had just this summer is every time I get on a plane and get off a plane, I'm experiencing a country club or a golf venue that I've heard about, read about, but never been to, and they just don't disappoint.
With the events that you attended this year, do you have like a favorite moment or favorite story from one of the events that, you know, obviously that had to be a very cool experience this summer?
I'd never been to a U.S. Girls Junior before. And when I walked onto the U.S. Girls Junior, there was a young girl, you know, Caroline Tuttle, who played in my home, was a member of my home course in Orlando. And I just saw her on the range. I walked in, I saw that's Caroline, and I've got 1,000 nicknames for her. And I saw her and her dad standing there. And to me, to stand there on the range and talk to the two of them and then to realize what this championship meant. Now, this is a young girl who's qualified for the U.S. Women's Open, played at the Olympic. I saw her at Olympic, you know, so you'd think that would be an even bigger moment for me this summer. But you just realize how much these USGA championships mean to somebody's amateur career and then pro careers. I mean, they're just, you know, there's places that they play, and then there's a USGA championship. And it's it was special for me to talk to. I like her. I like her dad. I feel they're family. And for them to say, you know, this was the thing we built our summer around, getting here to Baltimore. This is where we wanted to play. And I'd seen her at Olympic, you know, months earlier, but I don't think she expected to qualify for that. But it just reminds you that what you're doing matter at every age, you know. To see a lot of my really good friends at Brooklawn, you know, for the U.S. senior women's. I mean, this is, you know, just to sit there and talk to LPGA greats and then have them just say over and over again how much they appreciate what the USGA was doing for them and to create this championship. That's special. You know, I always tell people, why work this hard if nobody cares? And in these cases, I really met athletes that cared.
I think that's one of the neat things with golf in general, and especially the USGA as somebody that, you know, spent a lot of their life, you know, chasing USGA tournament, trying to get in, and is the lower level tournaments. Like there aren't a lot of other sports. Like the NBA doesn't have amateur basketball championships. Right. Like, you know, there's nowhere for 28-year-old mid-am basketball players to go compete on a national stage. And I think that's one of the things is that I would, you know, say to a lot of people is like, those are some of the most fun championships to attend. Like the most fun I've had attending an event in the last 5 years was the inaugural Senior Women's Open here, yeah, where, you know, you're out of this incredible golf course and you're seeing it. It's just there's a different energy at the lower level events even than the, you know, the big men's open or women's open. And I'd say the women's open has a different energy than the men's open. And it's worth exploring because like being able to walk without the ropes around. I mean, it is a, you know, I think those lower level USGA events don't get as much attention or love as they deserve because they are so neat, you know.
Even the big ones, I would tell you that when I came back from the US Open in Torrey, and I did an interview the next morning. It was the next morning. And of course, they wanted to talk about Rahm, and it was unbelievable. It was a great week. But somebody said, what was the moment you most remember about that week? And I said the amateur dinner, which I think was like on a Tuesday or Wednesday night. Now, we couldn't do a dinner this year because of COVID. So, and it was outside and it was drinks, but it was, I think it was Andy North gave a little talk about, you know, what it meant. And I ended up over the course of the night, I met every amateur in the field. And, you know, these were young men that were in the absolute pinnacle of their career. It's funny, as commissioner of the LPGA, when I rolled into the U.S. Open and the U.S. Women's Open, my thinking was, we really ought to have more LPGA and PGA Tour members exempt into these fields and fewer open slots. Because, I mean, you know, just these open slots don't turn into after the cut and wins and everything else. And after going to both and really getting into the process of qualifying, I realized that the U.S. Open, the U.S. Women's Open are the most open championship in the world, right? I mean, if you got a low enough handicap and you can get the ball in the hole, you can play in the U.S. Open. And I mean, to your point before, I mean, I don't care how great your summer was, you're not going to be invited to play in the NBA championship. Like, it just doesn't matter how many shots you hit down in your neighborhood pickup game. But if you have that kind of summer and you can find your way, you might just tee it up at the U.S. Women's Open and finally the word open meant more to me. I mean, I would throw the open word around pretty easily at the LPGA, but then when you get here and you really look at what it took to get here and the qualifiers from all over the world, it's one of the things that really makes it special, because it's the most open professional and amateur championships in the world. And they're purely non-discriminatory. The ball doesn't care what you look like, how old you are, where you came from. If you can get in the ball in the hole with least number of strokes, you're going to be playing in one of the greatest championships in the world.
So I'd be remiss here if I didn't talk about, you know, the hottest topic in golf, obviously.
But you're the best I've ever been interviewed with in my first 60 days in terms of how long it took you to get to this.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, usually the over-under is about a minute and a half.
I want everybody to listen to the other part of the interview. So
when you actually edit this, this is going to be the first question you asked, right?
No. We put it at the back because everybody's got to listen.
You got to force them through all the stuff. Okay,
exactly,
good.
Exactly. Something I'm always interested in, I see this word thrown around a ton, and I've never really understood who stakeholders mean. So, you know, you see with the distance debate, it's like, oh, we're going to talk with stakeholders. Like, who are stakeholders? You know,
yeah.
You know, like what level does it go down to? You know, obviously, I think everybody just assumes equipment manufacturers and PGA Tour players and LPGA players. But like, who are the stakeholders?
Yeah. So I mean, when I talk stakeholders, I talk about entities in the game that both lead and push the game forward and have a lot to gain or lose from the decisions we make. So, you know, you're right. I mean, it's equipment manufacturers. It's the tours, it's tour players. It's, it's golf course venues. So it's, I think it's important that, I think in this role, I've said this many times, in this role, I'm going to have to lead in a huddle. I'm going to have to bring the huddle together. I'm going to have to listen to the comments. And at the end of the day, someone's going to have to make a call, make a play. But I really think it's important that we actually lead via the huddle. That doesn't make it easy. It doesn't necessarily always make it popular. But I do think there's a lot about this game that I think goes unnoticed from the average fan. And what I mean by that is, and this is me in my soapbox, but I would just tell you there's I don't think I could be the head of the National Croquet Association or the head of the National Darts Association or the Bowlers of America Association, because I'm not really sure that there's enough stakeholders in there that really move the game forward. When we announce a championship in golf, 30% of the advertising is gone already from manufacturers and supporters of the game that want to be part of that. You don't get that in tennis. You don't turn on the U.S. Open tennis tournament and see all the ads from golf, from tennis balls and tennis rackets. And it just isn't there, but it's there in golf. And I don't think you can blow that off. I think one of the things that makes golf exciting is how much research is spent in this game. So when somebody says to me, well, that's easy, just have a tour ball, shut down everybody on a distance, and that's the new game. I mean, that's fine. But I think my job is really to make sure that there's as much energy about the future of this game 3 years from now that there is today and 20 years from now that there is today. And I want engineers to wake up every morning and say, I see the rules that he put in place, but I'm going to spend a lot of hours today working on how to get excitement even within that space. I can't throw a wet blanket over that, or I think I lose one of the things that makes this game truly exciting and great. If I see a club under the Christmas, if I see a package under the Christmas tree that looks like a golf club, I'm just like anybody else. I get pretty excited about ripping it open because maybe there's two strokes of handicap in that box, and I don't want to lose that. I don't want to lose that excitement.
An interesting thing with the history of the game is that, and this is with a lot of innovation in society, is that when restrictions are placed on engineers, innovators, that's when the most creativity comes out. And obviously, like, I think one of them, if you go back to, is like when the Haskell ball came out, there was obviously a lot of debate, and then they got rules and specifications placed, and then they came out with a better ball like the week after they put the rules in that fit all the specs. So I think that's one thing I always think about, is that history is going to repeat itself. If you put regulation in, people are going to innovate regardless. That's their job, right? One question I would have centered around that is, like, how do you manage people's financial? Obviously, I think this is where a lot of purists would come from, is the manufacturers, different entities' financial interests with their feedback centered around the, you know, future of the game and sustainability.
Yeah, I don't know that everybody I talk to loses a lot of sleep about whether or not golf will be better 50 years from now than it is today. And I get that. I mean, that's not everybody's job, right? Some people have a job to hit a quarter. Some people have a job to get members paid. Some people have a job to, you know, to get events on the schedule. I've had those different jobs as well. But I think I'm one of the few that drives to work every morning thinking about whether or not golf's going to be better in 30 or 40 or 50 years than it is today. And I think that's our responsibility. I mean, that's our job to be that voice. I do know that, as you know, we have a ton of roles at the USGA, whether that role is rules, whether that role is championships, whether that role is green section and agronomy, or whether that role is being a cop. You know, and sometimes we have to be like the traffic cop and say, this is how fast you can drive on this highway. It doesn't mean you love the cop, but it also means that, you know, with that cop, at least you get order and lack of chaos and a belief in sort of the future. So I'm not going to back off the responsibility. In some cases, we'll have to be a traffic cop and say, how far, how fast. But I also don't think the way to get there is to just to say innovation out. Here's the new ball. Everybody plays it, or here's the new club and everybody plays it, or here's the new rule and there's no way around it. I quite frankly, when you said, don't you think history is going to repeat itself? I do. I think we're going to establish some guidelines. I think those guidelines are probably going to slow some of the pace of progress over the next 10 or 20 years. But are we going to figure ways around that to actually continue to push the envelope? I'm actually counting on it. Because I think that's what makes the game exciting. I also think that I have a responsibility to make sure that when you look at that over the next 50 years, the decisions we made to actually control some of that pace didn't obsolete every game in the, you know, every course in the country, didn't make courses west of the Mississippi no longer an option, because that's when you wake up and say, whatever happened to ... fill in the sport, because they didn't really care about the next 40 years. They only cared about today. So finding that right balance is important. I'm going to work hard to find that balance, whether or not we'll strike it exactly right. I don't know, but we can't shy away from the responsibility that we have that, quite frankly, nobody else really shares.
Is there, obviously everybody sits and talks about this. This is an endless debate. If you bring it up on social media, you'll be filled with, you know, you'll be talking about it for a week. But, you know, is there any imminent, like, when can we expect maybe something about obviously the distance report came out and we're in this evaluation period. When can we expect to see something from this evaluation period?
Yeah, I think at this time next year, I think next summer, we'll be talking about some real specific suggestions, recommendations, and be going through the same process. We were in the beginning, we would put out the distance results. We then talked about, you know, some of the areas we want to look at. We've listened to feedback. I think, you know, come this off season, we'll take all that feedback in and try to determine some specific directions. And then we'll do the same thing. We'll put it out there and let people feedback. I don't expect everyone to say, Mike, USGA, great job. Because like I said, being a traffic cop sometimes isn't the greatest. But I think at this time next summer, we'll be having an interview and you'll be saying, tell me about point number four. And that's what we'll be talking about. Yeah.
I mean, nobody likes change. You know, that's
everybody likes change. They just don't want change in their game. Please change somebody else.
Yeah, yeah. It's an interesting. I think like the whole thing. Everybody's got bias. Like I love classic golf courses, so I'm biased. I know that. Like I write about classic golf courses. I don't want them to be, you know, extinct. One of the things I've always found interesting is that there's one stakeholder that has huge financial gain to be made from the distance to keep exploding. And they're golf course architects and they're vehemently opposed to the distance, which is like amazing to me because like, okay, if the golf ball keeps going further and the clubs keep getting better, they're going to have to keep building more back tees and keep adjusting golf courses and keep making more money. But they're the group that always is vehemently opposed to this whole thing. And it's just something that I always like find, I chuckle about. Are they a stakeholder?
Well, I think the bottom line is when you talk about great golf course architecture, it's no different than great artists. I mean, when you finish the painting, you don't want the painting to be obsolete again in 20 years just because nobody cared about the painting 20 years ago. So I think it's one thing to just say I'm going to add back tees, but I've not met a golf course architect who says, yeah, just put a tee back there 50 yards, I'm good, because that's not what the original vision was or the original design. So I think they're a stakeholder that's hoping that we protect some of the original vision of these great venues that they created. But there's a, you know, there is a compromise here that we'll find. You know, it won't be overnight and it won't be easy, but we'll find a compromise that says, listen, and at the end of the day, I still want long hitters to be long hitters. I still want them to have an advantage versus a short hitter. I want them to, you know, but if they go for it and two, to have risks that maybe the guy who laid up doesn't have, that's part of the game. So, I mean, I think the people that think we're going to wind everything back and, you know, everybody's going to be the same 195 yards off the tee, come on, that's not realistic. And I don't think we want to take athleticism and strength and figuring out a way to swing the club harder if you can do it and keep it in the fairway out of the game. So, we're, you know, long hitters are going to be long hitters. Difference makers on tour and different makers in your home club are still going to have those advantages. But I think if we just turn the other cheek and say, nothing wrong with this game, the people who say that to me don't really care about golf 40 years from now. They just, please don't touch my game. Please don't touch my course. Please don't touch my tour. I get that. But I think if that's the answer, I think there's a real risk that 40 years from now, they're going to say, I've said this many times, you can make a critique on the RNA and the USGA that said, why have you waited this long to take a look at this? And I think that's a fair critique. But should you be looking at it? That's not even a realistic critique. Of course, our job is to make sure we keep the game as good as it was 30 years from now, if not better than it was today. And not paying attention is not an answer.
Well, especially with what's going on globally with environmental concerns and sustainability, you look around the world and around the country, it's like golf courses take a lot of resources and you do not want them to take more resources because that is something that, you know, puts the game at jeopardy.
Yeah, and I don't want to go down the whole global warming path, but let's face it, when a golf course has to get that long, it's expensive. It's expensive to maintain. If you think as a golfing population, we're not paying for that, you're kidding yourself in terms of fees and country club expenses and everything else. More importantly, do you think there'll ever be an urban golf course built again if it needs 8,600 yards to build a golf course? And people say to me, well, you don't need 86 unless you're building a golf course for the top elite. But I've never met somebody who's got a plan to build a golf course who doesn't want to have a course that could host major championships. So, I mean, I just don't think we want to make this game only a suburb game, you know, only a game for the wealthy. So again, that's how you wake up and go, whatever happened to. So, listen, there's no single magic bullet, at least not yet, but we're certainly going to come with some suggestions that I think at a minimum can continue to have excitement, can continue to have innovation, at the same time protect the fact that, you know, we want to make sure that our golfing venues can be our golfing venues in the future. And quite frankly, the only way to get to a golfing venue can't be to drive 2 hours into the country.
So outside of this whole distance debate coming to some resolution, what are you most looking forward to in the coming years as the CEO?
Actually, I know it sounds crazy to say this, but I'm looking forward to this challenge because this challenge will require us to bring the industry together, even in ways where we don't like each other. But at least, you know, to me, it's like I said, I think it's a fair critique to say, where have you been? But I think it'd be a much fairer critique if in 3 years you go, seriously, you did nothing. So, I mean, I think that's, I'm looking forward to figuring out how to do that with and for the industry. And again, letting half the people tell me I'm crazy and half the people not. I mean, that's like being a commissioner. You get used to that.
Well, yeah, I mean, you've got the job that nobody's ever going to be happy with you, you know?
Right. It's perfect. It's just, but so I think that'll be fun. I think it'll be, to me, it's exciting. I've pretty much been a global guy my whole career. And I was about taking brands global, whether it was TaylorMade and Adidas and, you know, the LPGA or Crest toothpaste. But this is a time when I can really be an American, you know, and really focus on some of the things. And I've said this many times. I really believe that I'm frustrated that there's not, you know, there's not Team USA. And if a young kid is growing up and has aspirations in this game anywhere else in the world, they're going to find themselves on Team Sweden or Team New Zealand or Team Australia, not here in America. I think we can solve that. And I think the USGA ought to be at the forefront of solving that. I think that we've provided incredible resources to golf courses, but we make it maybe too hard to find them or maybe too expensive to get a part of them. I think we can solve that. I think there is so much research not happening as it relates to water, as it relates to a golf course. I can promise you we're going to spend tens of millions of dollars in the next few years to really make sure that golf courses need half the water that they need now in the long term. And I think if we don't do that, who is going to do that? I think we can endow some of these great amateur championships if we put our mind to figuring out how to do it. So these are all things I'm trying to get my head around 60 or 90 days in, but I feel pretty comfortable by the time I get to 2022, I'm going to be laying some of these things out in terms of action plans. But all of those things to me are necessary, they're doable, and the USGA ought to take the lead on them.
All right, Mike, thanks so much for the time, and really look forward to our next chat, and congrats again on the new role.
Thanks again. Talk to you soon.
Thank you for listening to another edition of the Fried Egg Podcast. Today's episode was edited by Garrett Morrison. As a quick reminder, we have the Ryder Cup coming up. The best way to stay up to date with everything in golf. It's easy, it's fun, it's for everybody. So for a golf nut, it's for somebody that's just trying to follow golf, is the Fried Egg newsletter. You know, if you're already signed up, great, refer a friend. We'd really appreciate it. You can sign up at thefriedegg.com. There's a bar that says newsletter right in the middle of the website. Sign up there, enter an email, and you're in, and you will get golf's best newsletter. I say that with extreme bias, obviously, but I believe it. 3 days a week, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and during the Ryder Cup, we will have daily newsletters. So, thefriedegg.com, sign up for the newsletter, whether you are a golf tragic or you're just trying to stay abreast. Actually, it's a good, funny story. Not funny, just an interesting story. I had an old colleague when I started the Fried Egg. She had just started dating a golf nut, and she told me how much she loved the Fried Egg because it gave her things to talk about with her boyfriend, now husband. And, you know, she credits a lot of her early relationship to the Fried Egg newsletter. She knew nothing about golf. So that's what it can do for the common golf fan, the beginning golf fan. Sign up for the newsletter. It's free 3 days a week, and you will know everything going on in the golf world. Will Nice does a wonderful job. Thank you, and we will see you next week with a couple episodes on the Ryder Cup. Thank you.